Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the Becker's Healthcare podcast series. I'm Ryan Muhammad, she, her pronouns, writer for Becker's Healthcare. Today, we are joined by Dr. Steve Klasko, General Catalyst Investor Elena Vibosh, and Gary Click, the co-founder and CEO of Odyssey Therapeutics, on the fourth episode of the Health Assurance podcast series, sponsored by General Catalyst.
What will healthcare look like in 2032? And how do we make sure we move toward more health equity and better outcomes? We've got a terrific tandem for this episode, and they're taking us deep within the future of drug discovery and computational biology. Our guests, Gary Glick, the CEO and founder of Odyssey Therapeutics, among other firms, and a colleague of mine at General Catalyst, former SoftBank Life Sciences head, Elena Vibosh. We started our conversation, as we often do, by leaping forward into the future 10 years and looking back to 2022. We like to call it healthcare time travel or the history of the future. So why don't I start with you, Elena, given from your perspective.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Steve. And maybe just by way of introduction, General Catalyst has committed to investing in life sciences because we view it as a way to accelerate the transformation of the healthcare system. So with our initial mission and health assurances to transform the healthcare system from a sick care system to a healthcare system, to bend the cost curve and to expand health access and health equity, we can get there faster with innovation.
That makes a lot of sense. And Gary, you know, so obviously I'd sort of like to have this go from the past to the history of the future. So what about your academic career in chemistry? If I came back to you 5 years ago and said, you know, Gary, you're going to be the founder and CEO of a precision medicine company, would that have made sense to you, or did you think you would just move up the academic ladder?
Well, this is my fifth company, so Odyssey is not necessarily a surprise. I think if I go back to my the first company, in some respects, I would say no, because I never thought I would be an academic. I grew up in central New Jersey, where pharma abounded in the 1980s. And as an organic chemist, most of us wind up working for large pharma. So that was always sort of the career path I thought I would wind up on. And it was just happenstance, I think, that I wound up in academia and really staying there for almost 30 years.
And then, so again, we're here in 2032. You know, you're now on your 10th company. Odyssey, has become, as big as Merck. But what does the state of precision medicine look like 10 years from now, as it relates to some of the things that we're investing in General Catalyst and life sciences?
Yeah, I think, there's a number of different ways to look at this. From the chemistry end and the small molecule end, which I know, General Catalyst has made a number of investments in, and a lot of other investment shops have also been looking at for capital infusion. We can get to molecules faster, drug-like molecules faster, and in specificities that we haven't ever really been able to see before. So for example, the ability to use large data sets to train models to design molecules in ways that, and with specificities for subsets of protein conformations, for populations, and then to rapidly develop those molecules using sort of multi-parameter optimization in very short periods of time is something that we have never been able to do before, which will really allow precision medicine in ways that's just not available today.
Yeah, so Gary's pretty special in his background of having made real drugs. They're in the clinic now. If we roll forward 10 years, where will your drugs be and what impact will they be having on patients?
So hopefully, those molecules will be commercialized, and will be impacting patients' lives. The drugs that I've worked on in the past, and we're certainly working at Odyssey, are aimed at large market indications. So for patients with cancer and autoimmune disease, and diseases that are in the tens of thousands, if not more, patient numbers per year. So we're really looking to extend people's lives, to make those lives better, so folks can live with less morbidity, less mortality, and ultimately reduce the burden on the healthcare system, by using sort of pharmaceuticals to get them, keep them out of the doctor's office.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm really impressed by with Gary's clinical development strategy is that same view of looking at 2032 and then rolling it all the way backwards. He's looking at where is their unmet medical need and starting with people who are sick. Before we can help create a healthcare system, we do need to work on the sick care system because there are people who are really, really sick. And so first figuring out how can we help people who have really significant needs, and then taking that and moving it backwards closer and closer towards keeping people healthy. And that scientific vision of going from very sick people to really that healthcare transformation of keeping people healthy.
Yeah, there are large numbers of illnesses today, numbers of illnesses, which lots of individuals that are really driven by things like Western diet, by lifestyle, and those, I was fortunate in prior companies to work on medicines that may address those folks, and hopefully healthier lives and really changes in lifestyle can have large impacts on those individuals. But still, for patients with many cancers, many autoimmune diseases, where we're looking at sort of multifactorial genetic diseases, lifestyle just simply will not, in and of itself, will not lead to better outcomes. So there will always be sick patients out there. And those really, that's the sort of the sweet spot for Odyssey and things that we're working on today and into the future.
I think that's such a great point, because the whole idea of health assurance, that was first highlighted in the book that Hemant and I wrote together, is that it's not that everybody's going to be well. It's just that we're concentrating on the 97% of people that wake up in the morning and don't say, I'm a patient. They say, I'm a person that would like to be able to thrive without health getting in the way. They might have cancer. They might have congestive heart failure. They might have diabetes. But we want to help them be a person. And some of that is helping them get better if they do have cancer or whatever, so that they can go on and lead that healthy lifestyle. So I think one of the things that I'd like to sort of maybe hit a little bit, and then we'll get a little bit more in the next segment, but it used to be thought that population health and precision medicine were sort of mutually exclusive, although there's either or. What I'm hearing from you, Gary and Elena, is that they're really one and the same, right? If we can start to get like the genomics of what the individual is doing and then look at sort of groups of people, we can get companies like Odyssey Therapeutics and, let's say, Color, and then some of the things we're doing around social determinants, and actually put them all together to create a healthier community. Does that make sense, or is that like too pie in the sky?
Yeah, well, I can say from our perspective that when we look at investing in diagnostics, the key question we have is, does this have decision impact? Will it change how doctors treat patients? Will it change patients' behavior? And so it's not too pie in the sky at all to say that you can have a company like Livongo making personalized recommendations and helping people take control of their own health, and then having genomic medicine tests helping patients understand what medicine is right for them, and having drugs that are developed for a patient population where they're more likely to be effective and better tolerated. So that's not too pie in the sky at all. That's already happening today. The question is, how do you balance society as a whole, developing drugs that can help a lot of people, versus developing drugs that can help a very, very, very small number of people quite a bit.
I just remember, you know, I think you know that I went to my MBA program with Alex Gorsky, and we talked a lot about that with J&J, you know, because they invested so much in things like river blindness and rare diseases. And I think what they would say is beyond the fact that it's the right thing to do, you also get some learnings from that can then go ahead and be, you know, very applicable to much larger diseases. And they had some great examples of things that they did out in Africa and that kind of thing that then became nidus for other things they were doing.
So, you know, if we can bring down the cost of developing drugs for in general, the ability to go after, you know, relatively small populations and do so efficiently will become, I think, a viable commercial strategy going forward. A number of companies, particularly in oncology, using the sort of the rubric target on oncology, where we can use genetic information to run very efficient clinical trials. If that can be applied outside of cancer to autoimmune disease, cardiometabolic, other indications, I think you will see those small groups being served and pharma going after that.
A quick timeout, then we dive into the thorny issue of the high failure rates in drug discovery and what impact AI and machine learning might have on that in the decade ahead. We'll tackle all of that and more. My conversation with Elena Vibach and Gary Glick continues on the other side of the break. Stay with us.
General Catalyst, investing in powerful positive change that endures. Check out this book from General Catalyst CEO and Managing Director Hemant Taneja. Unhealthcare, a manifesto for health assurance, at Amazon or wherever you purchase your books.
Welcome back to the General Catalyst Health Assurance Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Stephen Klasko. Let's get right back into the mix with Gary Glick and Elena Vibach. So, Gary, this is going to be a softball question. It's a little bit like, how come you look so darn good? But I'm going to ask it because the other questions will probably be a little tougher. But, like, how have you been able to succeed so well in this sort of small molecule and startup drug development thing when, you know, the failure rate is pretty much what really what last place teams have as far as, you know, I hit 240 or 280. You seem to have a pretty good record of success. So what's the secret sauce? You're just smarter than everybody else? Or is there something about how you've approached the problems that you can share?
So drug discovery is the ultimate team sport. And it's really the ability to recruit superstars and nothing but superstars and organize them in a way that allows them to collaborate in an unencumbered environment and do the science and do the development in the most rigorous way possible. And you don't stop until you solve the problem. I think too often there's too much second guessing on teams. There's not enough focus and people quit too early. And we've been very, very fortunate to using a very simple team approach to be able to solve problems across multiple companies for targets that, you know, many pharma and other biotechs wanted, and we wound up, you know, getting there first multiple times. So I wish I could point to a particular tool or this or that or the other thing, but it really boils down to people and organization.
That makes a lot of sense. And look, that's true throughout GC, I think, even in the healthcare delivery side, which I'm more involved with. But Elena, I'm really curious from that perspective, because I think if I had gone to the GC folks 4 or 5 years ago and, you know, and said, you know, how come we're not doing more in life sciences, they would have used that as an example because, you know, the failure rate is too high. Now, obviously, they brought you in from SoftBank to correct that. But how do you pick that? And how did the GC match.com between Gary and GC or Odyssey and GC happen?
Yeah. So how do we think about the challenge of the failure rate being just so high? I think the reason we do these investments is because everything GC invests in, we only go after hard problems that other people are afraid of, where it's going to take too much time or too much capital, and where there's enormous impact potential and other people don't want to go. That's the privilege and the opportunity of working at a firm that has a mission to be an enduring company. And then the way we do it is not too dissimilar from what Gary said, which is we invest in great people. We look for companies that have a core technology platform that lets them discover drugs that couldn't be discovered in any other way. And a team of seasoned drug hunters that are focused on making real medicines for high unmet medical needs. So when we invest in platforms, they have to be solutions. We can't invest in platforms that are looking for a problem. And that's how we think we get to a higher probability of success. We know we'll have lots of failures, but we think there's a higher probability of success with those ingredients, and that whatever our companies make will have a big impact.
So it's sort of the VC, it's the VC switch to like translational research. When I started as dean, you know, our researchers were just, hey, this is something I'm interested in. I don't know if it's going to solve any problems. And we moved to a model of much more translational research that just about everybody to get a grant has to basically say this could solve a problem. In some respects, that's what you're looking at from a GC perspective of how do we create a stable of potential things, knowing that not everything's going to make it, that can really start to solve significant problems in precision medicine and population health. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
So to that end, you know, AI has become like, you know, it's like, hey, I have an AI company. And, you know, the fact is in 2020, you know, you could put AI in your title and your company is worth $2 billion and healthcare delivery, you can't do that anymore. In some respects, in life sciences, there's a little bit of that sort of aura around computational biology. Oh, wow, you're doing computational biology? You know, that's going to be big. So let's talk about that. What are the things that are happening in 2022 that literally will be the Internet of Things in 2032? We'll say, well, yeah, that piece of computational biology or that piece of throughput and small molecule development really was the game changer. And then what might be a black swan that could happen that would really turn around the kind of things that you're doing in drug development?
One of the nice things about being in my 60s is that I have a long perspective. And, you know, computational drug discovery is very hot, it's very sexy today, but it really got its start in the late 1970s. And it has been a very slow, steady slog over really 30 years to get to where we are today. And, you know, one of the things that I think is truly transformative is the application of machine learning to drug discovery. Not the, you know, what we call linear regression, what is quantitative structure-activity relationships, but true deep machine learning. And I think one of the things that we will see, you know, my predictions for 10 years from now, is that the use of deep learning or the application of deep learning to the problems in drug discovery, from target discovery through molecule discovery through clinical trial design, will be truly transformative and really jump over physics-based approaches, more, I would say, traditional techniques that have been worked on and refined over the last 10, you know, 20 years or so.
And Elena, you know, how do you view that? I mean, you know, what are the really exciting technologies, not companies, but exciting technologies that as a managing partner of GC and the person that's responsible for life sciences, you say, gosh, you know, we have to have a company that's doing that. I know on the delivery side, I'm thinking a lot about maternity because I'm an OB, but I'm thinking that, gosh, you know, it's crazy that the people that are getting pregnant are generally younger and everything they do is digital. Except, you know, when we need to do tests on them, they all have to come in the hospital. As my daughter said, I thought you were the digital dude, Dad. How come when I was pregnant, I had to come into Jefferson all the time? On the life sciences side, what technologies Elena, are you excited about that? You say, hey, you know, I'm not sure which company yet, but we really have to get involved in this in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. So computationally enabled biology, right, is a really broad theme. We obviously are in there. We have to keep playing there, but where do you go? Right. So I think there's a lot of companies that are focused on target discovery. And that's really, really risky. That's a really challenging place to play because you have to go from I've used machine learning to make a target to, okay, I'm going to have a hit, then a lead, all the steps to making a drug. It's kind of like that song, I'm Just a Bill, where the bill has to find its way to Congress. There's a song called I'm Just a Little Biology Idea, and you've got to make a long way to becoming a drug. Yeah, the farther upstream you apply AI and ML, the more you better have really great drug developers who can bring that drug all the way through to capture value. So we invest all along the spectrum, but I think some of the most interesting technologies that you'll see are things, for example, in helping you make in vivo experiments more parallel, more multiplex, because right now you go one mouse at a time. So how do you massively multiplex mice? Then in the clinic, how can you use synthetic control arms or simulations of real-world evidence? How do you integrate novel prospective trials with other ways to accelerate drug development? Because that's so much of the time and the cost along the drug development lifecycle.
Up next, we'll dig deeply into the approvals process and how novel drugs make it to market. There's a lot to chew on there. This is the General Catalyst Health Assurance Podcast. We'll be right back.
General Catalyst's Health Assurance Podcast is brought to you by Becker's Healthcare. Becker's offers a suite of niche products from every area of the healthcare industry landscape. Stream episodes that feature interviews and conversations on healthcare's most pressing issues from the thought leaders who are tackling them every day.
In the final phase of our interview, it's not just drug discovery that needs to change. In this final block, we'll shift to the FDA and the clinical trials that ultimately bring those discoveries to market. By 2032, my guess is those need some change also. So Gary, you know, this world sounds great. You know, we're developing molecules, we're computing, we're simulating, we're then, you know, getting it out to people. What's wrong with that scenario?
So there's three sort of buckets that, you know, you can sort of think about in the process. The discovery of targets, which is more biology, the discovery of therapeutics, whether they're small molecules or proteins, and then the development. You know, my sort of crystal ball would tell me that we probably will not have spent enough investment, put enough investment on the clinical development, and I think that's the longest, most expensive, sort of toughest, you know, sort of road to hoe, that we will do about right in the sort of the therapeutic area in investment. I think we're gonna come to learn that, again, you know, deep learning is going to be transformative there. And we're gonna find that target discovery, sort of the application of machine learning to large in vitro data sets, was probably more times than not misleading. Just simply because the ability to simulate the appropriate conditions in vitro that are therapeutically relevant for target discovery, we probably got that wrong. And I think the companies that ultimately become the appropriate data moats, you know, again, looking out on the clinical end, are going to be extraordinarily high value companies, and they're going to be not many of them, and those are going to be real winners.
So, I'm so glad you said that. One of the black swans that I've gotten excited about is the whole bioprinting world. You know, there's a company that I'm working with that's actually has created a fully scaffolded bioprinted lung, you know, for research that instead of having to go from the Petri dish to the rabbit, literally could cut off a couple of years. I think those will be some of the changes. Elena, So let's assume that we've solved some of these issues and we now have a drug ready for clinical research. It seems to me that we're still in 2022, you guys were still in the, let's put an ad in the paper and find, you know, 10 people between 60 and 70 that have high rheumatoid factors or going to your primary care docs. Is that going to change? Is GC looking at some things around getting clinical research out of the 80s and 90s and using AI and computation in a very different way?
Absolutely. So the way to think about it is, one, how do you make traditional clinical trial research operations better just using normal technology and existing regulatory frameworks? And two, looking back in 2032, have there been major unlocks in what the FDA will accept and what are novel ways to get to a regulatory clearance that are still proving the safety and efficacy of the drug and getting there better, faster, cheaper? The first one is a hell of a lot easier, and we're already working at it. It's amazing that it hasn't happened yet, but clinical trial research today is heavily pen and paper. It requires a lot of people going around looking at paper medical records or even looking at electronic medical records and then transcribing them manually into another electronic data capture. They call it electronic data capture, but it's actually human manual data capture. It's a very misleading name. So we're investing in companies like Vial, which are next generation clinical research organization and site management operations that are a fully tech first clinical research infrastructure. So that's step one. That's entry level to solving the problem. That's just straight up, like in many industries, you've seen technology go into other verticals. So name your technology enabled traditional vertical. That's what you're looking for CROs. So technology-enabled infrastructure for CROs. Late to the party, but very important transformation. Then the more interesting thing, or I shouldn't say more interesting, then the thing that I want to know in 2032 is, looking back, what will the agency accept? How much can you use real-world evidence as a potential registrational data package? How much can you use a simulation of what would have happened in a placebo arm to augment the study power? So still having some patients in the placebo arm, but not as many. How much can you use Bayesian statistics to have a more iterative trial design that gets you to the right drug dose faster so that patients can start benefiting from medicines faster? So those are some of the big unlocks that are a little bit more black swan and dependent on the agency as much as it's dependent on AI.
You know, as I think, you know, as we get better drugs, more personalized, those, the sort of the effect size is likely to go way up. If we have the right, the picking the right patients and, you know, having better signals there will allow, I think, the agency to accept things that they just simply don't accept today, because they're not going to have to be sort of squinting at, you know, does this work, does this not work? It's going to be crystal clear.
I love that optimistic view, because Gary's saying, like, we're going to have easier approvals because drugs will have a bigger effect size. I kind of wonder, when you have really effective medicines, it's very hard to show incremental effect size on top, right? So you have, you know, PD-1s, immune therapy for cancer, that have transformed cancer therapy. You actually need a hell of a lot more patients or a really potent drug to show a big effect size on top of that. So I like Gary's optimism, but I have some doubts.
Well, you know, again, if you're going for a relatively, if we're subsetting patients and we can go for true precision medicine subsets, I think I don't know. I think there's reason to be optimistic. I hope I'm right.
I hope so too, because we're investors in Odyssey, so.
And I hope so too, because I work with General Catalyst, and I'm 68 years old, and we'll probably need some of these drugs. And you know, what's interesting about this series of podcasts, you know, since I've been in all of them, it all sort of comes together, because when we interviewed and we had a great discussion with Ken Frazier, and we were talking about social determinants of health. Okay, you've got all this science, And we talked about them making clinical research out of the 80s and 90s, but then some of it is doing it in a culturally competent way, right? I mean, you know, I mean, we recognize with the vaccines, the number one thing around vaccine distribution when I was at Jefferson was radical communication and having, you know, African-American folks go to African-American churches, you know, and get through some of the things that would keep somebody from doing a clinical trial or getting a vaccine. Same thing was true in the Latina population, et cetera. So that, to me, is where some of the social issues of health insurance come together with the science and the delivery.
Well, if you sort of look at the number of therapeutics companies that have been started over the last 5 years and will likely to continue to grow, and the efficiency of drug discovery, both protein therapeutics, small molecules, and the pace at which novel modalities can be developed, we simply are going to need a better regulatory framework to move all of that through the system. There's just no way that we're going to be able to do it, you know, in today's framework. And then on top of that, the ability to test those medicines, both, you know, in terms of the clinical trial support framework, it has to change. There's just no way we're going to be able to exploit that innovation with that back end.
You know, that's a really interesting point. And, you know, and that is that at the same time that we're expecting to have a hockey stick trajectory in some of these scientific things, our FDA and most of our regulatory bodies are not ready for that. I mean, so, you know, we've talked about this on the bioprinting side. At the point that I am, you know, not asking my niece, you know, to take her kidney out because she matched with me to get a kidney, but I'm actually creating a kidney from autologous tissue, what's the FDA's role in that? And there's nobody there in the FDA today that could basically deal with that problem, but it's probably a very optimistic thing they're going to have to deal with.
And we saw, you know, a couple of weeks ago, the report of reanimating, you know, pig tissue. I mean, imagine if that, you know, can be developed and translates even 1% of the potential we could all probably dream about.
Yeah, the pig heart transplant is a really interesting case study of what you can do in harnessing nature's machinery. So that's another big area of focus for us is, you know, Gary's taking AI, applying it to chemistry, synthetic approach. Opposite end of the spectrum is how do you take things that the body already knows how to do and uses it? Making a heart, like engineering biology is really hard. We haven't figured out how to engineer a whole heart, but pigs have them. And it's a much easier engineering problem to figure out how do you immune tolerize a patient to accept the pig heart. So one of our portfolio companies, Carius, actually was able to detect, unfortunately, the infection that led to that patient's transplant rejection, eventual death. So pigs have a certain virus. It's porcine cytomegalovirus. And what they wanted to do was to raise this pig in an entirely sterile environment so that they had a clean pig heart to transplant into this patient so that they didn't give an immune suppressed patient a pig virus. Unfortunately, somehow this pig ended up with this virus, which is super common and harmless in pigs. And it eventually triggered graft versus host disease and transplant failure. The Carius test in this case was used retrospectively, but what they can do is detect microbial cell-free DNA. So tiny little fragments of DNA that are found in the blood from an infection, from a virus. So think about that. All of your human blood, tons of it, and tiny, tiny fragments of viral DNA. And before the patient was symptomatic from his samples, they could say, oh, look, there's this infection. So you could use that to prophylactically treat and clear the infection before it's symptomatic, or even better, to check the pig out and double check, like, hey, I thought I raised a clean pig, but this is a dirty virus pig. This heart's not for me.
What about this podcast is we've gone from the smallest molecules through pigs to the body creating their own organs. So we're going to end really with where we started as far as the music piece. So Gary, you're a brilliant chemist. You know, your home, and you know, my guess is, if I ask you what's the last song you listened to, it's going to be the Adagio number 3 by Beethoven or something really, really. So what's the last song you listened to where you're sitting today?
Echo Beach by Martha and the Muffins.
I never would have guessed that. You see, that's the great thing. You just never know. Now, Elena, I'm going to ask you a slightly different question. Okay, we've talked about some really difficult concepts here. We're sitting there in 2032, and we say, wow, things have really progressed. Give me a song that you'd say, hey, you know, this really sort of explains, you know, what really had to happen.
A song that explains what really had to happen for our 2032 computationally enabled drug discovery is Hypotheticals by Lake Street Dive. And she's wondering about what's going to happen with her boyfriend. Our chemists don't have to wonder what's going to happen with their experiments. It won't be hypotheticals. The machine will tell them, and they'll have a lot fewer experiments to run to make a great drug.
All right, so Hemant, here we have another VC idea. If we could actually, on a first date, be able to look into the future and see how this is going to go, we could sell that to Match.com for billions of dollars. So as somebody who met his wife on Match.com, I think that's really another company we could look at. So this is great. Gary, Elena, I think we've covered just about everything in life, starting with the smallest molecule and ending up with what you might predict with your boyfriend, girlfriend, or partner. So thank you very much for doing this, and we look forward to seeing where all this amazing stuff goes with Odyssey and GC and others. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Steve.
That concludes this episode of General Catalyst Health Assurance Podcast. I'm Dr. Stephen Klasko. I really hope you'll join us for our next episode. That's when I'll be speaking with Glenn Tolman, the founder and CEO of Transcarent, who's bringing a whole new approach to corporate health plans here in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us.